Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, Irish legend Brendan Gleeson talks about Dublin gangsters, Celtic clichés and a career in cinema. Director Vadim Jean reveals a black injustice in a Louisiana jail in his new documentary, In the Land of the Free. And Peter Bradshaw joins me to review Sandra Bullock's Oscar-winning performance in The Blind Side, Jessica Hausner's award-winning Lourdes, and Iranian rock flick nobody knows about Persian cats. It's got more banter than an Irish boozer. It's Film Weekly. Brendan Gleeson's film career began late, when he was 34, and you wouldn't say he had the typical looks of a leading man, but the actor has amassed an impressive number of memorable performances, with full-blooded roles in Braveheart and Michael Collins and Harry Potter, as well as becoming a specialist in deadpan Irish noir, with comic gangster films such as I Went Down, In Bruges, and his latest, Perrier's Bounty. In it, he plays underworld lord Daniel Perrier and is joined by the cream of Irish talent for a violent caper about a young crook, Killian Murphy, struggling to repay his debts and narrated by Gabriel Byrne as the Grim Reaper.
This individual, why is the name of Michael McCrae? Last night he imbibed to beat the band and today he's paying the seedy price. It's evening. He's having himself a little siesta, yeah? Little catnap. Now relax yourself and pay close attention. There's a point to all this drivel.
I met up with Brendan Gleeson and I asked him about playing a character with such a fearsome reputation, yet such a bubbly name.
I was absolutely insistent that he was Perrier, by the way, not Perrier. As far as I'm concerned, that's a Celtic Tiger affectation that everybody in the film calls him Perrier. I have no idea why they do that. My name is Perrier. But he's a kind of a gangster, basically, but he has great notions of himself as a liberal, sensitive thinker, one with ethics and all sorts of various other things, which he gives great lip service to, but actually hasn't got a shred of.
there seems to be a genre of this kind of fella, this kind of Irish gangster, which you cornered the market in all the way back to I Went Down as well. These kind of very florid but ruthless and quite violent gangsters.
Well, yeah, they're all very differently presented. I mean, I was just talking earlier about they've been written by, you know, Conor McPherson, John Boorman, Martin McDonagh and Marco Rowe, all of whom are fantastic writers, and I have absolutely no kind of fear of being stereotyped in any way. They're all very different characters. With Perrier, the great kind of gift for him, for me, was with him, was that he's a total hypocrite. He professes. A lot of the others would have been people who spoke, you know, who had quite a tough exterior, but had a kind of a certain humanity underneath. With him, no, it's the other way around. He professes great humanity, but actually he has nothing to back it up with except cruelty and psychotic behaviour. But he does have kind of a good turn of phrase, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the films that you just went through there. I Went Down, The General, In Bruges. What am I missing?
Top Marks and then Perrier's Bounty. That's well done. That's yeah, they were very different people. Yeah, obviously they were kind of involved in nefarious activities, and they're always, when somebody has, you know, a different conscience to others or no conscience at all, it's very liberating to kind of go in there. It's quite a power trip, actually, even as an actor, to go into a place where you have no conscience. Mm-hmm. You can be very, very insouciant, to use one of Perrier's words.
Do you know what, on my notes, which aren't there, I've written the insouciant. I've written, that was my favourite moment, because it's typical of him to use this wonderful kind of French affectation, if you like, just before you're about to kind of, you know, AK-47 someone's knees off.
Well, exactly. But the point is, I mean, he doesn't mangle the words. I mean, he knows what they are. Who's to say a gangster can't be well read?
Yeah. It seems to me that you represent Dublin so often. I was at the Dublin Film Festival with you a couple of years ago when In Bruges kicked it off with you and Colin Farrell, and obviously you were, you know, holding court there, Brendan, in the manner that you do. But do you have a feeling that in these films that you sort of represent Dublin in some way, and that there's I'm not saying it's a cliche, because it's a genre now rather than a cliche, but do you feel that you're kind of creating a myth of Dublin, or is this an actual fair reflection? Are there loads of characters like Perrier?
No, I mean, they're all creations, obviously. I mean, the interesting thing, say, for example, within Bruges was that the characters were written originally as Cockneys. You know, there were very few changes we had to make. There were about seven changes in the script when we decided to make them Irish, or when Martin McDonagh decided to make them Irish. So I think there's a much more universal kind of urban thing that's going on in film now that has really very little to do with either Dublin or Ireland or any specific place. I don't know. I don't think I represent Dublin as such. I get to work there the odd time, which is kind of fun. You know, people like, they like the larger than life characters that show them up as being, you know, rapscallionish. We did a film recently with John Borman called Tiger's Tale, where people were less inclined to kind of clap us on the back for kind of showing Dublin and all its Celtic tiger excesses. So you never know. I mean, obviously you try to explore what you know, and it's always a great joy to do it. But I'd hope it wouldn't be just a parochial kind of thing.
Mm. You are a Dub, born and bred. Do you feel a sense of pride then in representing? I don't think it's no bad thing to represent and to kind of, I don't know, you're almost become the face and may I say, body of Dublin.
Well, I mean, it's a sad reflection, isn't it? If my body is the body of Dublin, it speaks unkindly of the city. No, I mean, obviously, there's a certain verbosity that I think people tap into, but it can become very self-indulgent if you're not careful. I'd hate to become a kind of a stereotype. I don't think it would serve anything well. And you know, I mentioned four writers. It's really about the quality of what's coming out, and these characters are particularly well drawn.
Absolutely. Well, there is another genre of the kind of blarney, the what I think we rather disparagingly hear but called Irish with an I, with an O-I. It's all about the kind of, you know, fiddles and the Guinness and the sort of a Hollywood view, sometimes the kind of the Waking Ned view. And you're never associated with those kind of films, it has to be said.
Yeah, well, oddly enough, I do love traditional music and I do love a pint of Guinness every now and again.
You partake in both, don't you? I've seen, you play, don't you?
I play a little bit, yeah, but not at a professional or even acceptable level. No, there are obviously the stereotypes, but I think particularly British audiences are very suspicious of certain sensibilities that the Irish quite enjoy. The Americans sometimes are quite suspicious of that type of verbosity too. You know, the whole spiritual aspect of things, I often find that British audiences are very intolerant of anything to do with a kind of a vaguely spiritual or magical, whimsical sort of look. I think culturally, it's interesting to me how, say, the British sensibility is so offended by anything to do with magic. I find it really, really interesting.
It's almost, why do you think it is?
Well, I think there's a practicality about the way people go about their business and they feel that it's insincere. I don't necessarily think it's insincere. And at the same time, I think the blarney that you talk about or the Irishness and all this kind of stuff is slightly pathetic. Even Irish people's reaction to it is developing. It's interesting. For example, The Quiet Man, which I still think is one of the most hilarious films ever made, at one point was very threatening to Irish people. They kind of felt it was patronising them and making them out to be gormless idiots. And that, you know, I mean, Irish people have been portrayed in that way before.
I think John Ford set out to make a comedy, as you think is the most hilarious film. Or do you think he did?
Oh, absolutely. Have you watched it recently?
It's not for ages, actually.
Oh, right? Go and watch it. It's absolutely hilarious. I mean, John Wayne actually kicks a woman in the bum, and it's kind of acceptable. And he did. Like, I saw him interviewed. He really did. He said, "Don't you think it's funny? I think it's funny. Don't you think it's funny?" Somebody was being outraged. No, I think it is absolutely hilarious. But I think when people were kind of feeling a little more defensive, Irish people themselves found it, as I say, patronising and you know, they were all drinking, fighting, all this kind of carry on. But I think when they felt confident in the middle of the Celtic Tiger era, it didn't offend them as much and they just thought it was funny. So it's interesting how it all goes. It depends on your sensibilities.
Yeah. And it's interesting for you as an actor who's kind of risen during that era, your fame and your star, let's say, maybe your technique was always in place and you've been working for ages, but during that Celtic Tiger kind of boom, you know, there was a film boom and that was kind of where we saw you internationally as well at home.
I guess it was. I mean, I suppose Braveheart was a big step for me. That happened in 94, and that would be around the beginning of that. But it felt coincidental for me. I think we got a proper tax break in after, you know, just prior to Braveheart. Yeah. And that really had more to do with it than the actual economy booming. In fact, I think in the end, the boom in the economy became, you know, it began to price us out of the market a small bit. And I think that's all been clawed back now. But I would have worked in parallel with it rather as part of it, I think. It was a kind of a very odd situation. But I mean, I've been lucky, obviously, in terms of the people that I got to work with. You know, who knows? We'll see what way it takes. The next few years will be interesting in terms of the creative direction that Ireland takes, in terms of our writers and all that. It's going to be fascinating now what turns up next.
But you're not one of those actors who, I mean, apart from Harry Potter, where you do actually kind of, you know, change your face and kind of costume. You're not one of those actors who loses weight, for example, or kind of changes or grows a moustache or kind of, you know, does wigs a lot. You turn up as yourself, really.
Oh, well, no, I think Mad-Eye was slightly different. I think Churchill was very different to the way. In fact, I put on weight for Churchill, which I've yet to lose, incidentally. Yeah, I mean, I had beards in Braveheart. I had kind of beards in a couple of things. I do actually change my look quite a lot, to the extent where I was getting away with walking down the street for quite a long time because, you know, I tended to change my own appearance and people didn't realise I was, you know. So I had a comb over, I think, for the general. That was the only one that kind of got me away with it.
That was the one that cemented it for me, that film, Brendan. I remember seeing it at Cannes. It was there in competition on that wonderfully huge screen.
Yeah.
And that, for me, was a tremendous performance opposite John Voight as well.
Yeah.
Still, I think, still underrated film, sort of commercially, but artistically just a landmark film. And from then on, you've always been someone that I've completely admired. Tell me about that film, work on it, because it did seem a watershed. It kind of allowed you to spread out and really put you on the map, I think.
Well, it was great working with John, you know, at the height of his powers. I think, you know, I remember we shot a camera test and he said, okay, that was a really good impersonation because, you know, this is a real individual, but I want to get somewhere deeper than that. And I remember going away and just trying to open doors, say, for example, that I had kept slightly shut, you know, or not slightly, but firmly shut, in terms of just going into places where actual harm and actual kind of violence happens. Mm. And I remember losing sleep over it and that kind of thing. So it was getting into a place where it was physically disturbing. And it was another level for me to go into that place. But working with him was huge, and it brought me as an actor to a different level, trying to dig and burrow deeper and to assault your own sensibilities, trying to get into a character's sort of DNA rather than just being slightly surfacey.
Just tell us briefly, Brendan, what the future holds for Brendan Gleeson. Where can we see you in the next year?
Well, I think, well, obviously the Harry Potter thing will come out. Basically, I'm trying to get A Swim to a Bird's Made, which is hopefully going to go in September. Which is the adaptation of a Flann O'Brien book, which I want to direct.
You're starting directing now?
Yeah, the nerve of me. so I'll just pretend to be a director. But it's like, I know, that's what I want to do. I've been kind of trying to adapt that book for the last 5 or 6 years.
What's the book again?
It's called A Swim to Birds. It's a Flann O'Brien book. It's kind of one of the classics. Mad mayhem of a book. And that's really what I want to get.
You're going to be in it and direct it at the same time?
Yeah, I will, but we had a table reading of it about 2 or 3 years ago. There'd be 4 generations of different Irish actors in it, and it's going to be a big one.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you're dealing with folklore and you're dealing with kind of, I don't know, something that's kind of dear to the heart of so many Irish. No pressure is what I'm saying.
Exactly. No, it does massive pressure. But it's where I live. I just love what's at the heart of it. So I just want to go and do it now.
Who do you direct like?
Like nobody on earth.
No, it doesn't surprise me. You don't look like anyone else.
Cheers,
Brendan. And Perrier's Bounty is on release in the UK from Friday, March the 26th. Last week, you may remember, we set you a competition teaser to win a retro 80s VHS in the hard box of The House of the Devil, a rather good and stylish Babysitter in Peril movie, complete with synth score and key dancing around with a Walkman scene. I wanted to know the name of the Government Act and its date that banned video nasties. Well, the answers came flooding in and we have a winner. It is Scott Bloomfield of Abingdon in Oxfordshire. He says the Video Recordings Act from the 12th of July 1984... Very precise, Scott. And for that, you've earned yourself a VHS. I hope you've got a player or you're just going to send it down the market and pawn it on eBay. Don't do that. It's a very good film, indeed. And video nasties are supposed to be passed amongst your friends in a kind of paper bag way. So do that in Abingdon in Oxfordshire. House of the Devil is on its way to you. This week we have a competition too to celebrate the release on DVD and Blu-ray, mod cons here, of Michael Caine's vengeful pensioner, Harry Brown. I have a sleeveless hoodie top to give away. Well stylish, you look bare buff in it, Bloods. Just tell me three other famous Harrys that Michael Caine has played and in which films. Answers must be in by March the 30th, please, to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Peter Bradshaw is here with us this week. Welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Many, many thanks for that, Jason. Delightful to be here.
Thank you for standing in for Zan Brooks, who is away. Peter, together we shall look at The Blind Side, then we'll look at Lourdes, and then we'll look at Nobody Knows About Persian Cat. It's a real mix of cinematic disciplines, as we shall see. But let's start with poor Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side, in which she plays a wealthy Memphis mom who adopts a gentle giant black boy from the projects and, through her goodwill and with God on her side, turns him into an all-star football player.
Look, here's the deal. I don't need y'all to approve my choices, all right? But I do ask that you respect them. You have no idea what this boy's been through, and if this is going to become some running diatribe, I can find an overpriced salad a lot closer to home.
Leanne, I'm so sorry. We didn't intend to...
No, we didn't, really.
I think what you're doing is so great. To open up your home to him and... Honey, you're changing that boy's life.
No. He's changing mine.
Peter, now, of course, Sandra Bullock won an Oscar for this. How?
God only knows. And I say that with all due respect to the divinity and to Ms. Bullock, God
knows. And to the Academy.
And to the Academy, who I wish to thank. I've never been more baffled, I think, not since Catherine Zeta-Jones won a prize for Chicago. Do you remember that?
Oh, God, how could I forget? Oggy, Swansea.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been more baffled. I thought it was utterly humorless, vacuous, frozen performance. It was like as if she was going to do a punchline any minute. But there was no punchline.
Exactly.
It was sort of serious.
There's not a star turn moment in there. I was thinking there's going to be an Oscar clip moment, but there wasn't. There's the bit where she comes on the field and sort of instructs the team how to kind of play like a family.
Yeah. Again, utterly fake, utterly unconvincing. I sat through the film thinking, as I do with lots of films allegedly or avowedly based on real life, that the real story behind this probably is fascinating. It probably, and very possibly, is as inspirational and fascinating as its fans think that it is. But this is just, it's just bland. It is, in the immortal words of Clive James, it tastes of cellophane. It is just nonsense.
For me, it was one of those TV movie of the week kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Was adopting this. The disease being here, the sort of, I suppose, white guilt in a way. Is there anything thematically about the film that you thought was interesting or fascinating, or at least playing with modern America? I mean, I'm fascinated how the film has become so popular, really.
Yeah, it's crossed over. My colleague John Patterson has a very interesting line on this in his interview with Sandra Bullock, is that it's one of those films which crosses over into the Christian Republican demographic, which is allegedly, avowedly ignored by Hollywood. Again, I am sceptical of this theory that Christians and Republicans are this sort of underdog kind of put upon group. But anyway, there we are. I think there is an interesting story to be told, which the film very evasively finally touches on at the very end, which is Leanne Tui, Sandra Bullock's character, is she in fact grooming Michael to be a mouthwatering gift for her alma mater? Her alma mater, which is a very important part of her own prestige and where she hopes to send her own kids.
Ole Miss.
Yeah, Ole Miss, the University of Mississippi. Is she kind of, has she got that semi-consciously in her mind from the word go? And if she has, so what? Is there anything so very wrong with that? That is the only thing of conceivable dramatic importance or significance, and it is interesting. But the movie skates around it.
What about the racial element of the movie? Where as we sitting there as white liberals, where were you on that? Because I mean, I found the kind of the white Christians gawping at this giant black boy and going, "Oh my God," as if they've never seen this creature from the project's lagoon emerge.
Again, I didn't have a massive problem with that. I think it sort of said, "Look, all you white liberals, does this mean we're not allowed to do what we're doing? Are we not allowed to have compassion? Are we not allowed to boldly leap the racial divide?" And I'm thinking to myself, no, of course, that's okay. And I didn't have a problem with that. The only time I had a twinge of old-fashioned white liberal concern is when Sandra Bullock confronts the nasty badass character and says, "I don't want to see you uptown ever again," which comes as close as a movie is going to get to conceding the de facto apartheid in Memphis, Tennessee. And I wondered if really we needed that line, or perhaps we did.
the boy is obviously very gifted and he's huge and he's the biggest bloke in the world. And suddenly, and the coach can't coach him at all. Then Sergeant Bullock comes on the pitch, sort of says, oh, your blind side is like a family, you've got to protect it. And suddenly he's like technically capable of tackling. He can pass, he can run, he knows the rules just from one lecture. The coach couldn't do that.
It's complete, it really is complete nonsense.
It's bollocks, isn't it?
It is total bollocks. And the biggest bollocks moment, there's an extraordinary scene, completely nonsensical scene, where the caring teacher fishes out from the waste paper basket a prose poem, which Michael has allegedly written, despite being, of course, apparently ignorant, about how he feels...
And it's all crumpled.
It's all crumpled, and she smoothed it out, and how he feels black in a white school. Everything seems oppressively white. And, of course, this is a sort of wonderful moment, and a thrilling rebuke to those nasty meanies who thought he was just pig ignorant. Again, it sounds like pure hooey, unless, of course, it turns out to have happened. I don't believe it. It certainly seemed very unreal.
That's The Blind Side. Oscar nominations, we know not why. Let's move on to another award-winning film. This time garlanded rather differently by the European Art House Festival circuit. It's from Austrian director Jessica Hausner, and it's called Lord. French actress Sylvie Testud stars as a multiple sclerosis sufferer who makes a package tour pilgrimage to Lourdes, seeking a miracle alongside thousands of others.
J'ai fait un drôle de rêve. J'ai rêvé que je suis paralysée. Et la Vierge Marie m'apparaît. Elle me dit quelque chose. Alors je me lève et je m'approche pour bien la comprendre. Et à ce moment-là, je remarque que je ne suis plus paralysée.
Peter, did Lord restore your faith in movies?
It did. It really did. I found this a fascinating, subtle, delicately comic film. I just adored it. I think it's Jessica Hausner's best film. What I found fascinating about it is that she is from the great Austrian, the junior branch, a younger branch of the great Austrian generation, which includes Ulrich Seidel and Michael Haneke. She, in fact, worked on Funny Games herself. And of course, when you know that, or even if you don't know that, you're on the edge of your seat expecting something kind of awful to happen. And I think Jessica Hausner, in a very witty and rather playful way, allows you to suspect that something awful is going to happen and then just drifts away from it at the very last moment. Each time and time again, I'm thinking, at any moment, something explicitly horrible is going to happen.
You've been watching too much Haneke.
Yeah, I know. But I genuinely think, even if I hadn't, because our modern, cynical, rationalist, atheistical expectations are so built in, especially seeing something at the cinema which isn't, say, a Harry Potter movie, which the fantasy element is accepted, something which is taking place in the real world at Lourdes. Well, Lourdes, you're expecting some element of disillusion. But what I found so brilliant about the movie is that without explicitly endorsing the miraculous in any theological sense, it had a kind of interesting spirituality.
Didn't it? I mean, I think that was... Do you think that's due to Jessica Hausner's directing style, which is quite static, locked-off shots, very kind of long takes.
Beautifully composed.
No, not... beautiful compositions, not quick editing at all.
No.
There's a sort of ironic detachment in there. Yes. It's almost as if she were some kind of god herself looking down.
I wondered about that. I didn't get the sense, which I get the sense from, say, Haneke's kind of glacially locked off shots in, say, Hidden, that of a kind of refrigerated detachment and icy kind of affectlessness. What I got was a kind of elegance, almost, I know everybody says, a sort of literary novelistic sense of framing, basically. Not a lack of compassion by any means, but a kind of delicacy almost in a way that these characters and their motivations were being presented, particularly the handsome young male volunteer. Again, who watching this film will not expect some horrible sexual moment to happen? And I don't want to start putting spoilers in, but that's really not what the movie's about.
The spoilers are, there ain't no spoilers.
Well, there sort of aren't any, but there are and there aren't. I mean, some things do happen important things do indeed happen in the film.
I mean, enormous things happen as well. The dramas are sort of giant, but yet so tinily done and so almost yada-yada. Just like the main kind of moment is kind of like, if you blink, you've missed it. And you say, did she just do that? These kind of events take on a very sort of slow progression. Even from the start, it's just people filing in, a very strange bunch of people as well, which kind of increases my love for the film, because these volunteers, the male you mentioned, they wear uniforms. They're Order of the Maltese Cross, I believe.
The Order of Malta, which is obviously a sort of religious organisation, which quite normally organises these effectively trips, what would effectively in the secular sense be called package tours to Lourdes. Lourdes, I never quite know whether to pronounce the S or not.
It's very old-fashioned. It's like Lions for Lyon.
Yeah.
And Kenya.
Lourdes and Wipers. I can't remember what the question was now.
I've distracted you with colonial pronunciation.
Yes, I found it extremely involving, these characters, especially Sylvie Testud herself, who gave the impression that, interestingly, she was at peace with her own condition. She didn't seem particularly fervent. She is detached from it, but not sceptical exactly. She absorbs the way that everybody else in the film absorbs the idea that, well, spiritual healing is the most important thing, and if there does appear to be a miracle, well, there is a well-established routine for logging it.
Is it? Do you know about this? I didn't know this. So if there is a miracle at Lourdes, you have to go to the doctor and get it kind of verified. And then they're quite cynical about it. They're saying, well, no, it's just a
It's not a kind of group hysteria thing whereby anybody who jumps out of their wheelchair will automatically get miracle status. By no means. It is dealt with in a rather detached manner. And all this immerses you in an atmosphere of, well, you know, this is what it would be like. And I found it completely, quietly compelling, and it was so plausible. It advances this possibility that it might actually be happening. And if it did happen, would we notice it? How would we react? And interestingly, what would happen if we had to absorb the idea that the miraculous is real? Does that mean that the miraculous is just as banal and silly as everything else that's real? And I've been doing the thinking about sort of Graham Greene. What would Graham Greene have thought about this movie if he was reviewing it? How would he? I think he would have loved it. I think his famous remark that it was only his sense of humour which allowed him to believe in God. And I think there is something of that little sense of humour in this film.
Absolutely, and I think Sylvie Testud is quite wonderful in it.
Wonderful performance.
Peter, we'll move on to a louder film than Lourdes, but also one boasting awards. A Cannes Award winner last year is Baman Gabadi's Nobody Knows About Persian Cats, about a young couple in Tehran who just want to fulfil their dreams of forming a rock band, only the music that they like is outlawed in Iran's Islamic government. It does exist, however, in a vibrant underground scene which we tour with them docu-style as they seek recruits for their musical dream.
این اسمش اسکارلت، اون یکی اسمش رد بادره. تمام فیلم‌های تاریخ سینمای هند و اینا دیدن. همینا فیلم شولر بده واسه بفهمید.
Peter Bradshaw, you now know about these Persian cats.
Yes, I do. I enjoyed this movie. I thought it was like a very old-fashioned kind of almost 60s style pop music film. It's a sort of movie that
Dick Lester kind of
exactly. It's a sort of Dick Lester kind of Ken Russell feel to it. It's very funny because it brings it home to you that this is the Iran that you don't see on the news, and you certainly won't see it in the high art house style movies of the sort of which Baman Gabadi has in fact made.
The Turtles Confide, which is a real kind of Macmal Buffyan type.
I mean, and it's very funny because having watched so many of those films, I almost got to the stage where I believed that people in Iran spoke like that all the time, that they really did speak in this sort of glacial way, and that they would look at you for 5 seconds without talking before replying. And what I find funny is that movies like this remind you, no, actually people are, you know, get over yourself. They're just like you and me.
And there are some young people in there who swear and kind of excitement.
And guess what? They like heavy metal. And I found it absolutely intriguing.
It's the first
I loved it.
Iranian film I've seen. I mean, I do like Iranian cinema, and we watched it. We saw the genuflect before it in this kind of because it's always attacking the condition of women in Iran or some things like that, all the poor people in the country and all that, and they're kind of almost parable-y. This one actually sort of had real people in it, and it also made it look like that actually Tehran might be quite fun.
Yeah, it certainly made it look real, that Tehran is a real place as opposed to the fascinating but very stylized sort of Knight's Move cinema which we've seen. The other interesting thing about it is that it's co-written by Roxana Saberi, who was this time last year, the centre of a sensational human rights trial, that she was convicted on a trumped-up charge of spying and sentenced to 8 years in prison, incredibly, which was eventually overturned after a gigantic international outcry led by the director, who at that stage I think may still be the partner of Roxana Saberi. But however apolitical the movie is, it's a reminder that there's nothing apolitical about Iran. And in fact, the movie is very political because it's about people who want to get the hell out of Iran.
And its climax is, of course, rather chilling and sad. Yeah. And of course, that brings down the kind of the curtain on the fun that Tehran was having. But the two musicians who are in here are actually here in London, and they live here in London now, and they're free to practice their music. And I believe that they're doing it in Brixton tomorrow night on the 23rd of March.
Great.
So that's a good thing.
Exactly.
That's Nobody Knows About Persian Cats, which we recommend. Do we recommend?
We recommend it, yeah, we absolutely.
But our film of the week seems to be Have Faith in Lourdes.
I would say, yea, verily, brethren, have faith in Lourdes, because that's the big one.
Yeah, take up thy popcorn and walk to see Lourdes. Put that on the poster. Peter Bradshaw, as ever, a pleasure to have you standing in for Zan this week. You can, of course, read Peter's blogs and legendary reviews on guardian.co.uk/film. She's a breath of life, tearing me inside. My arms are open, my mind, my soul is tired. Filmmaker Vadim Jean, so named as his parents met in Cannes and loved the French filmmaker Roger Vadim, directed Leon the Pig Farmer nearly 20 years ago, so it is something of a surprise to see him return this week with a passionate documentary about the Angola Three, a trio of black prisoners on death row in Louisiana's notorious Angola jail. Robert King, Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox have spent a combined total of a century in solitary confinement, accused, wrongfully, believes Jean, of the murder of a prison guard.
In Louisiana, there is a place called Angola Prison where three men have spent between them over a century in solitary confinement for crimes they insist they did not commit. Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox have been held in solitary confinement 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 37 years. They have always maintained their innocence and that they were targeted for being members of the Black Panther Party.
Samuel L. Jackson narrating there, and the film touches on the civil rights movement and the history of the Black Panthers and really digs into the archives. And I'm delighted to say that Vadim Jean, director of In the Land of the Free, joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Film Weekly, Vadim.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. First time you've been on the show. But this is probably because this is the most urgent and exciting film that I've seen you do. It's a complete... I mean, anyone that I, you know, said that he did Leon the Pig Farmer, and now he's doing In the Land of the Free. This is not about an escaped piglet and his journey. This is amazingly moving and I was going to say very enjoyable, perversely, stuff, because it's such a well-made documentary, Vadim.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very, very personal project. I spent the last 2 years back and forth from Louisiana filming and editing for quite a long time. It's a story that I heard about from Anita Roddick. I have to say she's one of the most inspiring people I've ever met. Mm. And she started to tell me about the case of the Angola Three.
So she was already on this story. She knew about it.
She had met the young lawyer, Scott Fleming, who's in the film, and heard about the case from him. And he then introduced her to Robert King, who's the member of the Angola Three, who was released in 2001. So very shortly after his release, she met him. Like everybody who meets Robert, she was completely inspired, and she got involved by supporting the lawyers in the case.
So, and it was at her funeral, I believe, that you heard him speak, and he was so charismatic, so moving, that you thought, I've got to make a film about this.
It was an extraordinary evening, and there were 3,000 people at the Westminster Central Hall, and Robert spoke very eloquently with immense dignity and, I have to say, charisma. And most of all, he played two telephone messages from Herman and Albert in solitary, which were their eulogies to Anita, because I think they really believed, and it is the case that she brought their situation to a much wider audience. And what they said was unbelievably moving. And as I walked across Westminster Bridge, because we were marching on Shell House, which of course Anita would have wanted, I was with David Abraham, who was then the chairman, the chief executive of UKTV, who had commissioned the documentary I'd made with her. So he'd brought us together. And I said to him, Anita's big thing was just do something. And it was like her finger pointing at me and saying, the thing I want you to do is to make the Angola 3 documentary. And so I said, I've got to do that. And the following day he rang me up and he said, what can I do to make it happen?
Your background is in comedy. Yeah. I mean, the last film of yours I saw was The Hogfather on
yes,
telly,
yes,
which is not even my sort of thing. Yeah. But I had to watch it because it was on at Christmas, and my brother-in-law is mad Terry Pratchett, and I saw your name come up at the end. I was like, oh my god, that's what he's done now. Yeah. So how do you then go from that to doing an extremely serious and very stylish documentary?
Well, it's quite interesting. I've given up ever getting a good review in Sight and Sound because I hate to say it, but I feel that the people who write for that newspaper have had their emotions surgically removed, and so I've given up hope. And I thought, well, perhaps there's a vague hope I might get a good review, but they described another strange turn in the hodgepodge of my career, and I thought, oh, okay. I apologise for not making the same film over and over again, but I think what it is that I am completely driven by the desire to tell a story, and I don't really. It's not that I don't care what the story is, but in this case, I had to make the film because Anita would have wanted me to do it.
Yeah.
And because the story is so compelling, you know, these men have to be set free. They have to get justice because it's a terrible injustice and it's a wrong that must be righted. And I'm driven by those kind of emotions.
So you're convinced, though, with these documentaries that kind of right human injustices, you're absolutely convinced that wrong was done and these rights must be righted.
I didn't really look at the evidence in any great detail until the moment when, the finger pointed. But once I did, I read the trial transcripts. And you go, okay, even if I'm the most cynical person in the world, however else I look at this, there ain't no way they got a fair trial.
Yeah.
And even if you go, you know what, there might be this doubt or that doubt about, you know, this contradiction or that contradiction, the one thing that's absolutely sure is that in this day and age, I believe probably in America, and certainly here, there is absolutely no way in the world that, presented with the evidence that there is in those trial transcripts, any jury in the Western world would convict these guys of the murder. And so I have to add to that that it's not just the evidence, it's also the character of the people, and also the fact that there is no justification for them having been in solitary confinement for 37 years.
Yeah, that's the real brutality of it, indeed. And that's kind of whether one is pro the release of these chaps, Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox, or not. One is certainly against the conditions of this prison, Angola. And that's what your documentary does very well. Delves into this the history of civil rights, the history of the Deep South, Louisiana, New Orleans in particular. Does so with kind of great use of archive and music and all of that. That must have been, on the documentary side of things, on the technical side of things, the fascinating thing of bringing your filmmakerly skills to light.
Well, we managed to find some incredible archive. In particular, there was an old Louisiana Educational Institute documentary from the early 70s, actually shot at Angola. And that footage, as far as we know, has not been seen since the early 70s. And
who are they trying to educate? Well, don't go here.
Well, yeah, interestingly, yes. That and also giving a history of the prison, because it's got an extraordinary history. It was an 18,000-acre slave plantation. You know, and there's a bitter irony that, of course, the way that the they work the fields now bears very little difference to the way that the slaves would have worked the plantations, you know, in the 19th century.
And it's called Angola because the slaves that worked on this land were from Angola originally.
Exactly.
I mean, I knew it from the Aaron Neville song, Angola Bound.
Indeed, which is in our film,
which
fact.
Suddenly pops up in your film.
Yeah,
I was like,
exactly.
Ah,
well, because his brother was in Angola. It's about his brother being in Angola. And the fact that actually, you know, there's a vast percentage of young, particularly African-American males who either have been or are related to or have friends who are in Angola. I mean, it's also in Monsters Ball. It's in the Sean Penn movie.
The Dead Man Walking.
Dead Man Walking. That's Angola Prison.
You have Samuel L. Jackson as the narrator, reminding me of the John Grisham movies that he's been in, The Time to Kill, of course, which I think is a southern set as well.
Yeah.
How did he get involved? How did you persuade him to narrate it? Because, I mean, other than Morgan Freeman, he would be the kind of the number one choice, and he does deliver a very committed performance as narrator.
He was on a chat show in the UK, and he said, in passing almost, that he was a Black Panther in the 70s. And I thought, oh, if I can only get him to see the film, I think he might say yes. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate at the time. I had the same agent in America, the same agency I was represented by. And so I thought, well, I'll send it to him and see what happens. I got a call from his agent within 24 hours going, Sam's very sorry. He won't be able to watch it tonight because he's at the president's inaugural dinner. But he'll be back to you as soon as he can. By the time I woke up the following morning, there was an email on my BlackBerry saying, Sam will do the voice. What he didn't know at the time was that while I was still shooting, way before he was involved, a very strange thing happened that for me summed up that thing about best of the best and worst of the worst, which was we were filming the cement truck sequence, which is when, you know, Albert had borrowed, shall I say? No, he stole a cement truck to get back to New Orleans on an occasion in the 70s. And we were filming that sequence. And while I was waiting for the cement truck to turn round, this kind of coupe, 80s coupe pulled up. And the window ran down, and this guy from Redneck Central Casting, you know, even had the gap in his front teeth, baseball cap on, ran the wrong way, said, hey, y'all, you making another movie? And it was fantastic. You know, it's so friendly, so nice. You know, here, you know, people honk their horns to ruin your sound. But there, he just wanted to know, you know. But by this stage, we were being a little cautious about what we were saying about the film, because I'd been banned from every prison in Louisiana. So I said, yeah, you're making a film about, you know, kind of about the 70s in Louisiana. And he said, ah, because they were making another movie back there on the river. This is a bio on one side and river on the other. And he said, oh, all right. He said, yeah, had that Samuel Jackson in it. Of course, we were hoping the Gators would get him. But he was serious. And the whole crew went, oh,
yeah,
okay,
nice.
Then. Nice to have met you.
Segregation, or at least the wish for it, is just alive and well.
And of course, if only I'd known, I'd say, well, yeah, it's good. Nice of you to ask, because Sam's in this one too. You know.
Where do we stand now? Where is the case now? Where is the always with a film like this, there's obviously an aftermath, and you hope that a film like this will raise consciousness of the plight of the remaining Angola too. What effect has it had?
Albert and Herman have spent 37 years in solitary confinement for a crime that I don't believe they committed. There have been various attempts in that 37 years for there to be retrials. They were tried separately, quite deliberately, we believe, by the state, because the witnesses in each trial contradicted each other, and they didn't want the same jury to hear those witnesses contradicting each other. As a result, their legal cases are at different stages in the process. The most exciting thing is that in September 2008, Albert's conviction was overturned in the federal court. And the court order was that he be released immediately or retried within 90 days. The Attorney General's Office of Louisiana, the state of Louisiana, chose to contest the overturning, because they can do that in America. The judges in the case were asked by the state of Louisiana to extend the time they had to prepare their case. So oral arguments were heard in March 2009. Unprecedentedly, Albert is still waiting for those three judges to announce their judgment. What we hear is that we will hear something in the next couple of months. You know, I'm really glad we've got a release for the film, but really the only release I'm interested in is theirs.
That's a brilliant and noble way to end, I think, Vadim Jean. Thank you very much. Congratulations on In the Land of the Free. It goes on nationwide release across the UK from Friday the 26th of March and plays as part of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival here in London. Vadim Jean, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of another Film Weekly. My thanks to my guests, to the great Brendan Gleeson, to Vadim Jean, and of course to Peter Bradshaw this week. The music you've been listening to is by David Holmes, the DJ turned composer and now film scorer extraordinaire. And this is his music from the closing credits to Perrier's Bounty. Don't forget that competition to win the Armless Harry Brown hoodie. Which other Harrys has Michael Caine played on screen? There are three others. Name them. film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on this edition, Kate Taylor, goodbye.